You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars, and it is episode 198 of Columbia Calling, coming to you here over the ether, over the airwaves, and talking to you about anything to do with Columbia, and of course, that affects Columbia. And that brings me to this week's episode 198. Yes, we're going to talk about Venezuela. It's just me. It's a soliloquy or a reflection on what is going on in our sister country of Venezuela. Perhaps not enough is being reported. We do, of course, see the news here in Colombia, but internationally, I think it's a little bit thin on the ground, of course, with what's going on in North Korea, the US, Charlottesville, everything else, Guam. Venezuela is being pushed aside, and yet what is going on is a tragedy, a humanitarian tragedy of epic proportions. So this will be a one-segment show today, talking a little bit about Venezuela. So Venezuela was once Latin America's exemplar nation, home to Simon Bolivar, you know, the great liberator of all of northern South America. And then after years, we can say, of political mismanagement and months in economic freefall, well, it's the region's cautionary tale. The Bolivar, their currency, is now carried in backpacks around instead of wallets. One unit is worth less than a penny. Can you imagine that? While production plummets, crime soars. Fights frequently, and we see this on the news, are frequently breaking out in food lines. The number of murders last year ranged anywhere between 17,000 and 28,000 people. No one knows the exact tally, but regardless, it would put it as the nation's murder rate, of course, as one of the world's highest. It's a lethal mix of street gangs, drug cartels, leftist guerrillas, and right-wing paramilitaries, and they're all jostling for power in this vacuum, in the absence of an able state there. So we've got an autocratic government of the president Nicolas Maduro, the heir to Hugo Chavez, and he's, Maduro is sharply intensifying his crackdown on dissent, and he's issuing arrest warrants for rebellious mayors, targeting unfriendly politicians, and menacing average citizens who speak their minds. Yet, if it's enemies of the state he's after, one threat looms larger than any other, and that's the flatlining of the Venezuelan economy. It's in a dreadful situation. Now, this South American nation, which was so rich, the number one exporter of oil in the 1970s, it's edging towards the economic brink after an internationally condemned election in July, which created an all-powerful Congress loyal to Maduro. So since the July 30th vote, the value of the local currency, the Bolivar, has fluctuated more wildly than ever. It's a significant feat for a country saddled with the world's highest inflation rate. As a result, street prices for staples such as bread and tomatoes have doubled in less than 2 weeks. New estimates from the large Venezuelan data firm Eco Analytica suggest that the economy could shrink 10.4% this year, thus exacerbating a four-year nosedive that some economists have already called worse than the United States' Great Depression. Potentially more dangerous, analysts say, is the prospect of a sovereign debt crisis that could bring the country to a whole new level of economic pain. We'll have seen in the press this last week that U.S. President Donald Trump, on last Monday, threatened to take and I quote, strong and swift economic actions if Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro goes ahead with plans to create a super legislature known as the Constituent Assembly. But this was done on the July 30th. So what are the swift and strong economic actions? The deteriorating situation comes as President Trump on Friday, last Friday, said that he would not exclude military options in Venezuela. The spiraling economic crisis is sending a fresh jolt of panic through crisis-hardened Venezuelans who are increasingly blaming Maduro. And with all branches of Venezuela's government and the armed forces now under his control, Maduro's biggest weakness appears to be the nation's crumbling economy and growing international isolation. The government there in Venezuela normally adjusts pensions and the minimum wage to compensate for inflation. But in a possible sign of empty coffers, empty state banks, it hasn't done that yet. As anxious Venezuelans have bought up U.S. dollars in a week after the vote, the local currency depreciated 45% against the dollar. And in the past week, the Bolivar clawed back lost ground, but price increases on the street remained in place. Imagine this, that a kilo of meat, that's 2.2 pounds, now costs around $2.50. That's 16% of the average monthly wage. So Venezuela has sunk into financial malaise on the back of a socialist experiment launched by Hugo Chavez, the leftist firebrand who died in 2013 after nationalizing gold mines and rice mills and other enterprises and bringing more of the energy sector under state control. Since then, the economy has suffered a far more profound collapse under Maduro, Chavez's anointed successor. The result of plummeting oil prices, mismanagement, and failed economic policies, including price and currency controls. Yet, we're now into 4 months of street uprisings, and we don't know exactly how many people have been killed, but it's up to around 120 at this moment, and thousands have been arrested. The opposition appears fractured and in disarray. Analysts say Maduro's longevity in office may now depend less on surviving an opposition challenge than on his ability to sidestep a catastrophic debt crisis. Already, Venezuelans are facing half-day-long breadlines and shortages of basics, from toilet paper to antibiotics. I read last year that the churches were running low on holy water. But a default on the national debt could generate even harsher domestic conditions, potentially damaging Maduro's support within the armed forces, his ultimate line of defense. Signs of discontent among low and mid-ranking officers have begun to surface, and we've seen that in recent weeks. And on Sunday past, a group of civilians and soldiers, apparently led by a former commander, attacked a military base in the city of Valencia after releasing a video pledging rebellion against the government. Some of these officers have now been captured, but what of the weapons taken? That was the report that came out as they stole weapons. The crumbling economy, experts say, could fan such flames. And in the wake of last month's vote, some analysts increasingly see default as not only possible, but likely. The question is, though, timing. Do they run out of money on their own, or do US sector sanctions force them to run out of money sooner? So far, Venezuela has managed to avoid a default largely for two reasons. Firstly, it is a huge exporter of oil. And secondly, Maduro's hard-left government has ironically been willing to work with Wall Street capitalists on creative bond sales, bond deals that have kept it afloat. Ironic when he's talking about the evil empire and imperialism, Yankee imperialism. But Maduro's defiant decision to proceed with last month's vote, could prove a game changer. Critics decried the election as a sham meant to bring all branches of government under his control. And the United States, along with countries in Europe and Latin America, have refused to recognize the new Constituent Assembly. As Venezuela begins to resemble a pariah state, experts say that traders may be loath to accept more of the risky debt swaps, the paying off of old debts with new and higher yielding bonds that have thus far kept default at bay. It will also be harder, meanwhile, for Venezuela to cover its foreign debts using cash. National reserves in Venezuela have hit a 15-year low of about $10 billion, and most of that is in gold bars, not cash. So any U.S. action to target the country's oil industry through sanctions, a step the Trump administration is considering after a string of sanctions on individual officials, could force a default-triggering cash crunch. Even if the U.S. government stops short of that, Venezuela's oil industry, battered by the corruption, mismanagement, and disrepair, has already seen its output drop by 20% in 2 years. Analysts suggest a default is likely within 18 months, but I would say much sooner. This year, Venezuela's big test will be in October and November, when it must scrape together the $3.8 billion owed in payments. Robert Wood, who's of the Economist Intelligence Unit, he's the regional manager for Latin America and the Caribbean for the Economist Intelligence Unit, he puts the chances of a military coup this year or next because of extreme economic conditions at about 40%. He said, and I quote, "We no longer expect that the December 2018 presidential election will be held as scheduled. We still expect that the opposition will take power, but that the fall of the government and consequent transition will be disorganized, triggered by economic difficulties such as default and or hyperinflation." So, taking that into mind, some observers argue that ceasing to pay the debt could actually give the government more to spend on desperately needed imports of food and medicine, although any windfall would probably be short-lived, given that foreign investors are poised to quickly seize Venezuelan assets across the globe. There is also reason to believe that Maduro could survive a worst-case economic crisis by unleashing still more official repression, and he's showing all the signs of doing so. Since July 30th, the pro-government Supreme Court has issued arrest warrants for five local mayors for supporting protests. Meanwhile, the Constituent Assembly has vowed to back Maduro's public calls to imprison more opponents and creating, and I say this as ironically as possible, in inverted commas, a truth commission. This week, that observers fear will be used to persecute government critics. Last weekend, it sacked the chief prosecutor, Luisa Ortega Diaz, the most important anti-Maduro voice left in the administration. Maduro is also singling out ordinary citizens. On Sunday, a pro-government election official was shouted at by shoppers in a Caracas supermarket. A video of the scene went viral, prompting Maduro to call for those responsible to be jailed for hate crimes. A pro-government newspaper later published a list of their names. As a model for the future, Maduro, he may look to Cuba for its special period in the late 1980s and 1990s when Fidel Castro survived a years-long hunger crisis after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But his regime, a bit like Robert Mugabe's in Zimbabwe and Assad's in Syria, has already managed to survive an imploding economy, but I don't know what a worse economic performance will do. So we'll see how it happens. I mean, remember what happened to Ceausescu in Romania in the 80s. He refused to give up power, even though his regime proved incapable of improving the economic conditions in Romania. He left the office in the worst possible way, at the receiving end of an impromptu firing squad. Will that happen to Maduro? I don't know. So to conclude, while there are many that see Venezuela and its current crises as the result of socialism, it seems, upon closer inspection and evaluation, that it is all about corruption, waste, fraud, and the abuse of power. Being able to feed and house everyone is the key to the survival of any nation or culture. And Venezuela has the natural resources and the capability to do just that. The government, and we say that liberally, changed what should have been a level playing field by shifting the power from the people to those in charge of its politics. Whether or not all socialist, communist, or for that matter, capitalist societies end up with an asymmetric and disjointed mode of organization is something to consider, given that the concentration of wealth among a few individuals typically creates conflict given the disparity between rich and poor. Most likely, Venezuela will end up changing its administration to bring about recovery from this current economic abyss. Perhaps the new regime may structure a new political organization that fosters market competition as well as social guarantees. And while the U.S. may end up becoming involved to assist the Venezuelan people in a regime change, one must also be aware that China may also come to the table with their own solutions. To reiterate, power corrupts, and it doesn't matter what type of political economy and social organization is in place. When the concentration of wealth becomes top-heavy and orders come from the top down, the system and its culture will end up collapsing under its own weight. Never overlook the fact that Venezuela at this moment is a pawn in what could be called a new Cold War. So on a personal note, as I bring this to an end, I don't have any sympathy at all for the bondholders of Venezuelan debt. They're playing financial, musical chairs with ever riskier bonds at higher interest rates in the hopes that they can unload them before the music stops. Regarding President Trump, he made a supremely ill-advised threat about keeping military options open. To be clear, the United States shouldn't and won't invade in Venezuela, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't take action. A second out-and-out dictatorship in the Americas is definitely not in the U.S. interests, and with little creativity, the United States could make a major difference in Venezuela with no military involvement at all. Since early 2015, the United States has been imposing targeted sanctions on individuals at the heart of President Nicolas Maduro's regime. They've been freezing bank accounts, banning U.S. entities from transacting with them, etc. More such sanctions were announced last Wednesday, hitting 8 additional Venezuelan officials. But these individual sanctions won't work. They don't work. Venezuelan officials learned long ago to keep the bulk of their assets outside of U.S. jurisdiction, away from Uncle Sam's hands. Such sanctions, then, are largely symbolic. They're a nuisance, not a real exercise of power. One alternative would be imposing sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry, which accounts for 95% of the country's export earnings. But if imposing sanctions on individuals isn't nearly tough enough, going after the oil industry is entirely too tough. In a country where food and medicine are in short supply, putting a hard stop to oil sales could set off a famine. It would also cause a politically untenable spike in gas prices in the United States. That doesn't mean sanctions are a dead end. It means that the United States needs to think creatively about smarter, shrewder sanctions to coerce the regime into backing down from outright dictatorship. What if, instead of stopping oil imports from Venezuela, the United States conditioned what Venezuela could do with the money? What if the United States set up a trust fund or something of that sort and declared that U.S. companies that buy Venezuelan oil must deposit their payments there, and that trust fund could disperse money only to pay for humanitarian necessities of the Venezuelan people? I am aware that since the United Nations Oil for Food program in Iraq was a cesspool of corruption, this kind of mechanism has been out of favor, but the basic policy idea is sound, and the scope to adapt it to Venezuela's circumstances is considerable. Done well, it could hit the regime where it would hurt most while protecting both the US motorists' pocketbooks and Venezuelan people's basic needs. The key to making a proposal like this work is to use it to empower what remains of Venezuela's democracy movement. The heart of the Maduro regime's headlong rush to dictatorship has been its refusal to share power in any meaningful way with the democratic opposition. Indeed, when the opposition won a huge majority in parliamentary elections at the end of 2015, the government responded by stripping the legislative branch of literally all its powers. And the US has often made statements lamenting of this state of affairs, but hasn't really done anything meaningful to counteract it. So why not implement a sanctions bill that created a trust fund for the proceeds from Venezuelan oil sales with Venezuela's National Assembly as a trustee? The U.S. could declare, in effect, that Venezuela's oil wealth could not be spent without the duly elected parliament's approval. That is in no way different from what the Venezuelan constitution already says. But given the Maduro regime's determination to ignore the constitution, some outside encouragement is clearly needed. Such a policy would radically upend the balance of power in Caracas, a regime that has found it costless to ignore the democratic will of the people for years would suddenly find itself needing to cut a deal with its opponents in order to pay their bills. And nor could it blame the US for a policy move that, in effect, just reiterated what Venezuela Constitution says. It's important to grasp that the US has leverage here, a lot of leverage. The vast bulk of the oil that Venezuela sells for cash goes to just two countries, the United States and India. And Venezuela doesn't have a lot of good options. Much of its oil is extra heavy crude that can be processed at only a handful of specialized refineries. And those refineries are, again, concentrated along the US Gulf Coast, along with a few facilities in India and China. Building alternative refineries would take years and cost billions, meaning the Maduro regime's hand in the short term is desperately weak. Regarding the threats of military intervention, said by our president to the north, President Trump, these are empty threats, and they only empower the autocrat in Caracas, handing him an enormous propaganda win. But smart sanctions to empower Venezuela's democratic forces could rally support from both Republicans and Democrats and from both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. There's a space for real consensus that can have a real effect. It's not too late for Washington to play a constructive and decisive role in Venezuela's awful crisis. So that's it for me today. That's it for me on Colombia Calling, episode 198. Think about Colombia's neighbors, Venezuela, at this moment in time, suffering on almost every single level. Colombia has moved, of course, and the region has been outspoken in their condemnation of Trump's comment about a military operation or intervention. Remember, of course, that Venezuela has more than 5,000 surface-to-air missiles given by the Russians during the Chavez era. So they have defense, and the only reason they have these is because of the threat of a Yankee imperialist invasion. But we must be thinking of how we can help our neighbors in Venezuela. The Colombian government, of course, has extended visas for Venezuelans who are here legally and who are working. There is a figure of how many Venezuelans are in Colombia, but I believe that figure to be so much higher with those who are here, let's say, illegally or without the appropriate documentation. If they do have the appropriate documentation, they will be able to extend these for up to 3 months and then beyond that, up to 2 years after that. So this is a good thing for Venezuelans with their papers in order. Of course, without your papers in order, they cannot be employed here in Colombia. Colombia will not take a military stance against Venezuela. This is Colombia's time to turn and open the borders to Venezuelans, much like Venezuela did for Colombia during the 80s and early 90s. It's now time for this hat to be worn by the other party. So anyway, please follow the news about Venezuela in Colombia, because the longer that this and Venezuela in the international press, because the longer that this proceeds, the more complicated it's going to become, in particular for Colombia as a neighboring country. So I'm Richard McCall, here for Colombia Calling. This is episode 198. Please read my blogs at richardmccall.com. You can find me on Twitter, Facebook, everything else. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with episode 199 next week.